call upon our Brother Greg to lead us in words of exhortation. Brother Greg, please.
Thank you, Brother Mike. Good morning, brothers and sisters, young people, visitors, guests. I don't know if you've noticed it in our daily readings today in 2 Samuel and in Matthew 18, there's without a doubt a very distinct common theme. It's not quite so apparent in the first reading, 2 Samuel, but I think you'll see it. I hope you'll see it anyways after we go through our exhortation this morning. It's blatantly obvious in Matthew 18, and we'll only make a passing reference to it because I think the lesson that's contained in 2 Samuel is a very powerful one. It certainly has a great impact on myself. It's the story we know of the last chapter in the story of Saul and David. And if we've been doing our readings throughout the last month, we remember that, of course, Saul was anointed king of Israel by popular acclaim at God's direction. And, of course, we also remember he was a man of significance. He was a man of stature. He was taller than all his peers. He was an apt warrior. He was handsome and rich. He's just the sort of man Israel needed to oppose the Philistine threat. It seemed ideal, with the exception that Saul was a flawed king, as we read through 1 Samuel. He forgot oftentimes where his power as king came from, and he made one mistake after another, even to the pursuing of his son-in-law, David, to death if he could. And yet he was thwarted in that. As a result, God decided to turn the kingship over to David, as we know, a man after God's own heart. Now, if that was just the story, it would be interesting, and it is interesting. It's incredibly dramatic when you think about it. But, of course, there's much more to that story than just a quick reading of either 1 or 2 Samuel. When you read through 1 Samuel, all of Saul's faults become apparent very quickly in contrast with David, his son-in-law. However, when you read through 2 Samuel, we realize that David himself wasn't without faults or imperfections. He had lots of them as well. And yet, when you start to compare these two kings, the first and second kings of Israel, David stands out as the one king who, throughout all his life, remained steadfast in his faith and love of God. In fact, in somewhat of a contradiction, David becomes the model king, the one all others are going to be compared to, the one after whom Jesus Christ himself will be named, the son of David, who will sit on David's throne. I mean, when you read 2 Samuel, some of the things David did doesn't seem like he would be the kind of king who would be where his greater son would be called the son of David, maybe the son of Hezekiah or the son of Josiah or Asa or some of the other kings. And yet it's the son of David who stands out in the record. So what is it, I think, that's remarkable about David? Perhaps it's his faith that gets maintained, even through his highs and lows. It shows the weaknesses of our human nature. That comes about abundantly clear in many of the stories we read in 2 Samuel. And if you read 1 and 2 Samuel, and just read them from beginning to end, it would be easy to see this as the classic kind of a human drama, with all the elements of what would be a Shakespearean play. You've got tragedy and romance and family conflict and madness and hate and betrayal and all of the other things that make a great play. But of course, it's much more than that. It's a story of a man chosen by God to bring his people to security and prosperity in the land that God had promised to one of his forefathers, Abraham. And here's the beginning of a dynasty that would start well, but would eventually fade away to nothing until at last God sends his own son to bring his promises to completion. It's an amazing story. And in our daily reading today in 2 Samuel chapter 1, We're in the middle of the narrative of David. David has been anointed sometime before, and he's had to wait about 15 years now since his anointing for Saul to die. And as 1 Samuel finishes, Saul is defeated by the Philistines and dies on his own sword. So if you just go back to yesterday's reading of 1 Samuel chapter 31 briefly, we'll just read a few verses there to kind of set the context. Beginning at verse 1, "Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. The Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua, Saul's sons. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was sore wounded of the archers. Then said Saul unto his armor-bearer, Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor-bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell upon him. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he fell likewise upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men that same day together." This is a story of tragedy, of extreme tragedy. From a purely human standpoint, at this point, though, when you consider the life of David, in the context of David, perhaps you're almost tempted to want to cheer. Because at long last, long-suffering David is free from the threat of Saul and is finally going to take up the throne, the promised throne and kingship. But when you read through 2 Samuel chapter 1, there is absolutely no sense of triumph as the story unfolds, is there? There's none in the chapter we read this morning. This is very unlike the kind of stories we read to our children, fairy tales where the wicked king dies and the prince who was banished from the kingdom returns to claim his inheritance. It's not like that at all. Instead, this is one of the saddest days in the nation of Israel's history. Her first king is dead, and all the princes. The people's choice had been a complete failure, and now the Philistines have defeated the king and his sons, and it's a dark day. And when you take a closer look at the narrative, the deeper character of David begins to become revealed. What's important about David in particular, about David's reactions to things. If you remember in the story of reading through 1 Samuel, David and his men were sent back by the Philistines from the battle with Saul and ended up in a battle of their own with an Amalekite raiding party who had kidnapped their wives and children. Now they've returned. They're unaware of the battle, of the outcome of the battle to the north. But then there's this man that comes into their camp, this young man, with news of the battle. And he comes to tell of Saul's death. And we notice what's happening here. And of course, as readers, we know the story and what's happening. But of course, David doesn't at this point. We know that this man is a liar. He's opportunistic. He's kind of a con man. If you read 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 1 to 3, "It came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag, it came to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul, with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And so it was, when he came to David, that he fell on the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, From whence comest thou? And he said unto him, Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped." Now, he considers his story to be quite credible. And it does, if you were listening to it from David's point of view and all the things you'd been through, perhaps it might have seemed credible. He'd torn his clothes. He covered himself with dust to make his appearance seem authentic. He elaborates the story with all sorts of details, where they were, the chariots, the riders bearing down on them, Saul leaning on his spear on his last legs, and his heroic action in dealing Saul the death blow, and then taking the crown and the bracelet to bring to David. But of course, it's all made up. It's a story and a fabrication. He knows that the best liars are the ones who can fabricate a believable story with lots of detail, and he'd provided that. Clearly, this Amalekite expects to receive a substantial reward for what he has done. He's wrought David a great service when you think about it. Finally, after 15 years, the rightful heir is about to take the throne. He had certainly heard about Saul's great hate for David and the fact that Saul had tried to kill him on several occasions. Everybody in Israel knew about that. After all, he's done him a terrific favor, hasn't he? Well, of course, reading on in chapter 1, we see that that's not necessarily the case. In verse 4, David said unto him, "How went the matter? I pray thee, tell me." And he answered that the people are fled from the battle. Many of the people are also fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. And David said unto the young man that told him, "How knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan, his son, be dead?" And the young man that told him said, "As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, 'Here am I.' And he said unto him, 'Who art thou?' And I answered, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said unto me again, 'Stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me, for anguish has come upon me because my life is yet whole in me.' So I stood upon him and slew him because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and have brought them hither unto my Lord." It sounds really pretty believable from somebody who doesn't know the whole story. But yet, the reaction to this story is pretty significant. It's not what the Amalekite expected at all. He was expecting elation, happiness, joy. The king is finally dead, and David would reward him with a great blessing. That's what he expected. Instead, the reaction is great. David responds with grief. He takes his clothes and rends them as a sign of mourning. So do the soldiers standing around him. And they begin weeping and mourning, and it goes on until evening. And he must have wondered, what's going on here? The Amalekite is no doubt thoroughly confused. Verses 11 and 12, David took hold on his clothes, rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening, for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. What the Amalekite obviously failed to realize or count upon in his very human way of thinking is that these men held God's choice as precious. Regardless of the failings of Saul, they held Saul as being precious. He was God's anointed. And it was a great defeat for the people of Israel. And not only had Saul died, but so had Jonathan and the other sons, David's great friend and companion. But more than that, God's anointed had been killed. And David is rightly described after God's own heart. For him, I think, is what we see when we read this account, is that David's ambition to be king, if there even was any ambition, was absolutely secondary. What mattered most was God's right to choose who should be his king, and God's right to dispose of his people as he saw fit. And when God anointed someone king, when God anointed him king, only God had the right to take away that position. And so as the mourning and lamentations went on throughout the day, at the end of the day, he calls the young man over and he asks where he comes from. And the man tells him that he's the son of a resident alien, I guess we would use in today's vernacular, an Amalekite. Now, the fact that he's an Amalekite isn't the only issue here, despite the fact that David has just come back from defeating a group of Amalekites, an Amalekite raiding party. It's more that perhaps this young man had actually lived in the nation of Israel for most of his life, maybe from his birth. That means he would have been absolutely aware of the significance of the Israelites and of their belief that Saul was the anointed king. He would have understood that, I think. At least there's a chance of that. And he probably even understood David's attitude to Saul as God's anointed one. David had never tried to lay a hand on Saul in violence. But of course, this young man isn't a religious person. He's an opportunist. That's what he is. He's thinking on a purely secular level, a purely personal, selfish level, as to how he can manipulate David to get some sort of a reward from him. Verse 13, David said unto the young man, What told him, whence art thou? And he answered, I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite. It's interesting, by the way, that in the Old Testament history of Israel, there are two other Amalekites that come out significantly to prominence. One is Agag, of course, whom we encountered in 1 Samuel 15, who in the end was put to death by Samuel. The other was Haman, of course, who appears in the story of Esther. Again, someone who was striving to manipulate events, first to rise to power in the king of Persia, King Xerxes. Then he uses his power to arrange for the great slaughter of the Jews. But in the end, his opportunism is overcome and he suffers a similar fate. Unfortunately for this man, he hasn't given a thought to the reality that he's living in the nation of Israel. David is well aware of the abiding hate Amalekites have had for the people of Israel over the centuries. This Amalekite soon realizes it as David first rebukes him and then passes judgment on him. David said unto him in verse 14, how was it that thou wast not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? The sense of relief at Saul's death that this man expected, and that even we might have expected if we were looking at this from a purely human point of view, never comes out. Instead, the one who claims to have killed the Lord's anointed is executed. Verses 15 and 16, David called one of the young men and said, go near and fall upon him. And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed. And so it's a fitting end, in a way, from a godly standpoint, for this Amalekite. But it shows us part of the character of David as we continue on. Because I think what's more important than the death of the Amalekite, which seems harsh perhaps to us, but when you look at it really from a spiritual light, that's the only thing that could have happened. I think it's the reaction of David to the news of the death of Saul and Jonathan and the other sons. Instead of a victory celebration, which you might think would happen, we find David composing this, probably one of the most profound lamentations in all of the Bible. And we won't read it all, but just starting in verse 17, and David lamented. This is after mourning and weeping all day. David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. Also, he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. How are the mighty fallen? And he goes on to give this amazing lamentation in a few verses. He even talks about, in his mourning, even the of creation withholding its bounty. In verse 20, tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, etc. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. And so even he enjoins nature, creation, to join him in his mourning, to withhold its bounty, dew, rain, and harvest. On Mount Gilboa, where Saul died, which was synonymous with fertility, now it's been defiled by the blood of Saul and Jonathan and all the other men who died on that mountain. And so he calls on nature to honor the dead, to fast and mourn out of respect for those who had died. In verse 21, he really pours out his heart. He celebrates the valor of those two leaders of Israel, Saul and Jonathan, joint leaders of Israel, valiant and strong. Here we see the dual images of war and honor, and both have to be remembered. In verse 22, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. There isn't one word of reproach for Saul in that. When you think of the possible reaction that David could have had from a human standpoint, there's not one single word of reproach against all the years that Saul had pursued him and tried to kill him. He sees only the camaraderie, the partnership of the father and son, joined as inseparable allies in their battle for God's people. Certainly, Saul was David's enemy at times, and he was, while Jonathan was his unswerving friend. But when they appeared together in the field of battle at Mount Gilboa, in this final battle, they were seen as partners working together, equal in strength and battle skill. And combined, they were a force to be reckoned with. But sadly, they are gone now. Israel has lost her first king, and David calls for Israel to mourn. He calls for the community to mourn. It's interesting, something we do when we've lost somebody we really love and care for. Mourning is something that needs to be done with others, and it's usually best done in a community. That's why we join together for funerals. I'm sure this week, which has been incredibly tragic, as Brother Mike and Brother Clyde mentioned, this has been an incredible week in the news. Nice in particular, that entire nation is in mourning right now for those they lost. And of course, it doesn't diminish the grief and pain for the loss of those that are gone, but sharing it throughout a community makes the losses a bit more bearable, perhaps. We need a community around us when we mourn the loss of a loved one. The person who died needs a community to express the loss that their death has brought amongst the community and to acknowledge the contribution to the lives of others. And that's exactly what David does. He acknowledges the contribution that Jonathan and Saul brought to the nation. In spite of all of the things that Saul had done, again, it amazes me that there's no reproach here. He could have brought up the litany of things that Saul had done, certainly in regards to himself. And yet, there's not one word of that in his lamentation, ever after that point, as far as I can remember. In verses 24 and 25, he finishes up, "Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places." And he gives this heartfelt lamentation over his best friend, Jonathan. "I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished." This is a devastating loss for David, at not only Jonathan, but Saul as well. It shows the depth of the friendship that existed between two men. It's not something you hear about much these days. Of course, we know it's not a relationship that's sexual or immoral or any of those things. It's a close bond between two minds who were spiritually bonded together by godly principles. And it's one of the primary lessons that comes out in 2 Samuel chapter 1. For those who are bonded by the truth, there is a much deeper relationship or friendship than mere friendship or camaraderie. It's not like being on a sports team, and I've been on sports teams in my youth. It's not like just having a shared experience. It's more than that. It's the kind of love where a person would gladly sacrifice their own life for their brother. If you sort of, you don't have to hold your place here, but if you turn over into John chapter 15 just for a moment. Perhaps the greatest commandment for us in this lesson, John chapter 15, verses 12 to 13. This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And so in David's lament for Saul and Jonathan, for the third time he says, how the mighty have fallen. And it's a refrain that sums up the sense of loss and, in his mind, waste, coupled with the recognition of their achievements as warriors. It begins and ends the lament, how the mighty have fallen. It's repeated as Jonathan is remembered, how the mighty have fallen. It's a lament, when you think of it, in fact, of our own human nature, because that's what happens to all of us, how the mighty have fallen. In the end, no matter how great we are or whatever we might have achieved, in the end, we're all going to fall eventually. And so it's yet another lesson that comes out of 2 Samuel. Just very briefly as we close, there's one other thing I think that ties these two readings we had this morning, 2 Samuel 1 and Matthew 18. And it's an important one, perhaps even more important than the other lesson. Through all of David's faults, his strengths oftentimes shine as brilliant lights, and they emphasize why he remains the preeminent king of Israel. He had lots of faults, significant faults, that would have defeated many other people. And yet David loved Saul, regardless of the hate that Saul showed him, and in the end, I think David absolutely forgave Saul. In fact, he forgave Saul continuously. He did it unreservedly. David clearly understood his own weaknesses and frailties, and he was not going to hold Saul accountable for them. David would leave judgment on Saul in the hands of God, ultimately. For his part, he had already forgiven Saul, and he was now lamenting his death. In Mark's gospel, in Mark chapter 11, this idea comes out several times in the Gospels, but in Mark chapter 11 and verse 25, this prayer that we often say, when ye stand praying, forgive if ye have aught against any, that your Father also, which is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses. For if ye do not forgive, neither will your Father, which is in heaven, forgive your trespasses. I think this is one of the most significant things that comes out in David's life. It shines out as a beacon for us because it's something we struggle with, I think. Of all of David's weaknesses and his strengths in particular, this is one of the most important. Many of us struggle with the aspect of forgiveness. Everybody wants it without question. I want it as much as you want it. But giving it and extending it to others is very hard. It is a challenge sometimes. And I've thought about it a lot. Why is it so hard to extend forgiveness sometimes, either to a real or a perceived wrong? I mean, David had real wrongs done against him almost continuously. And yet there's obvious forgiveness there. It's kind of interesting when you read through Matthew 18 that the most difficult math problem, I think, if you want to call it that, in the entire Bible is faced by humanity. 70 times 7. That's how many times we are asked to forgive. It's just a number that goes beyond any of us will ever have to. How many times should I forgive my brother or sister? 70 times 7. Perhaps the hardest thing to do in the life of the believer is to forgive somebody who's hurt you, often badly. But Jesus says the alternative to forgiving is to not be forgiven ourselves. That's what we face. And so that's a sobering thought. And yet our human nature often only sees the wrong that has happened to ourselves, and it wants retribution or retaliation. One of the reasons this is hard for us, I think, is that maybe forgiving a trespasser or forgiving somebody else means allowing an injustice to maybe go unpunished or something. There's lots of reasons, I think, but perhaps that's one. This attitude portrays a defective spiritual understanding. At Christ's arrest, told in Matthew 26, Jesus told Peter to put the sword back into his sheath, not because Jesus didn't believe in punishing evildoers. Jesus told Peter he could have an armada of angelic warriors at his side, and one day he would. But judgment was not yet, and it wasn't Peter who was to be the judge. And I guess that's the point. When we are forgiving, we are leaving judgment, if that's what is going to happen, up to God. It's up to God to decide what to do about something. And it also offers another opportunity for reconciliation as well, and for an individual to see the error of their ways and to seek the forgiveness of God. But if we retaliate, there's almost assuredly not going to be the case. In Romans chapter 12, just to finish up, verses 19 to 21, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord.'" Isn't that exactly what David did? There's no hint of vengeance or revenge or retaliation or reparation or any of that sort of stuff. "Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good." Like David, we should not be so concerned about revenge or those sorts of things, but about the spiritual welfare, the one that has wronged us. More about the wrong going unpunished, perhaps. Romans 12 again says, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay.'" This morning we have an opportunity to remember the Lord Jesus Christ, who gave his life for each of us poor sinners, everybody needing forgiveness, absolutely everybody. David himself said in Psalm 51 and 32, Psalms 51 and Psalm 32, "For thou desirest not sacrifice, else would I give it. Thou delightest not in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, broken and a contrite heart. O God, thou wilt not despise. Blessed is the man unto whom the Lord imputeth not iniquity, and whose spirit there is no guile." David certainly recognized the need for his own forgiveness and didn't hesitate in extending that to Saul.